All right, so this is Unfuck the Poor. I'm your host, Joe Love, and the first things first, if you've been enjoying this podcast, and I know 12 of you are, do me a favor and give us a 5-star review. Tell your friends about us. Tell them Unfuck the Poor is the only podcast you listen to. Just lie to them. They won't know the difference. Today is an amazing episode, and by amazing, I mean horrible. The subject is horrible, but my guest today is amazing, and she is fully capable of introducing herself. So, Caroline, who are you?
Hi, Joe. I'm so excited to be here on your podcast with you. I am, most importantly, the stepmom to your child's best friend.
This is true.
But separate from that, I am a professor at Vanderbilt. I'm writer in residence in the Department of Medicine, Health, and Society. I write poetry. I also yell about the world in op-eds and sometimes on MSNBC.
I saw that.
And I have a cookbook, and I have a TV show on HBO Plus about social justice and food and personal narratives and all of those intersections. It's called Hungry for Answers. It was produced by Viola Davis. Check it out, everybody, if you feel like it. And I
love the show, by the way.
Oh, thank you. People who watched it like it. Not enough people have watched it. Please watch it. And if you are listening. And what else? I'm a Nashville native, and I am a concerned American, and I am very excited to have this conversation with you this evening.
I'm looking forward to it as well. And so you said you have a cookbook. What's the title of your cookbook?
My cookbook is called Soul Food Love, 100 Years of Cooking and Eating in One Black Family with Memoirs and Recipes. And it's about sort of the lost food ways of the Black American South and the ways in which we forget the breadth of the kind of food that we had access to, and how that has impacted our health. And so I won't say it's a healthy soul food cookbook because people shake their head at me when I say that. But that's kind of what it is.
I love it. The show, and in particular, your table in the other room that is made of cookbooks is the primary reason that I thought of you for this episode, because you focus on not only ingredients but also specific foods like Nashville hot chicken, but also sugar. I really love that episode. And today I picked a very special ingredient today just for you because of your obsession with food and apparently cookbooks. Today we are talking about the most important ingredient in the entire world. You cannot live without it. You cannot cook a dish without it. It's water. It's also the most boring ingredient. Specifically today, we're talking about water infrastructure, which is a very boring topic, but it's not, because it's tied to basically the very foundations of civilization. And we're specifically talking about the water infrastructure of Mississippi, and specifically Jackson, Mississippi, which is not in good shape. Are you abreast of the situation at all?
I am abreast of the fact that the water is profoundly polluted, and that it is specifically, I mean, I don't want to compare it to Flint because it's not the same. It's not a parallel crisis exactly, right? But
it has parallels.
But like Flint, the water that people have public access to in Jackson, Mississippi, is polluted and is just, and that crisis is disproportionately impacting communities of color in Jackson.
Exactly.
In ways that are having really wildly bad health outcomes.
Perfect. And today we are going to discuss how it is much worse than probably people realize, because it is bad.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
And by oh, good, I mean, I'm glad we're getting the word out. Not oh, good that that's happened.
Like I said, today's episode is absolutely horrible. So water may not be the sexiest ingredient or the most flavorful, but one cannot overemphasize it's important. And I want to look at water first in this episode in a global context before we get hyperlocal into Jackson's failing infrastructure. And I want to talk war and water in the third world, also in Europe, but very briefly. So last year, when the war in Ukraine unfolded in the first few months, I was hyper-focused on it. And something that took center stage was Russia's targeting of Ukraine's civilian infrastructure, specifically their water treatment plants. This left hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians without a source of water, and they resorted to collecting snow and purifying water from puddles. it happened in the late winter, and they would literally go outside and collect snow that had fallen, dirty snow, like from the streets, and they would boil it and drink it. And in the first days of Israel's 2023 assault on Gaza, one of Israel's first retaliatory measures was to literally shut off the main water supplies feeding Gazans. And if you follow any Palestinian users on TikTok or Instagram, you may have seen some videos that show Palestinian journalists and civilians posting how they get their water. It basically just shows them standing in line for hours, just waiting to get a few liters of water. And they do this day in and day out, walking several kilometers to stand in line and then walking back home. Of course, potable water is good for more than just drinking and bathing. Hospitals need clean water for dialysis, sterilization. Mothers need it for baby formula. And it is crucial to a society's sanitation needs. In short, without access to clean water, a population cannot survive. If you want to inflict as much harm as possible to a people, take away their water. And there's a reason that targeting civilian infrastructure is a war crime. In non-military terms, it is simply cruel. Citizens cannot defend themselves against rockets and tanks, and they pose no military threat. The point of such attacks is to make the people suffer. There is no other motive. For the hundreds of millions of Americans who have uninterrupted access to clean drinking water, withholding water from civilians is an unthinkable violation of the human condition. We wouldn't stand for it. Unless you're black. For this episode, we need to understand what makes drinking water unsafe. And unsafe can describe two scenarios. You have bacterial and pathogenic contamination like E. coli, Giardia, Salmonella, and hepatitis. You also have Legionella and Cryptosporidium. There's a whole lot of shit. You can treat all of these by boiling water and treating it with chlorine or iodine. If you're going to have contaminated water, pathogenic contamination is at least treatable by heat and some chemicals. Chemical contamination is the presence of things like lead, arsenic, nitrates, glyphosate, and chloroform, just to name a few pronounceable chemicals. And this is not easily treatable at home. You can't boil lead or chloroform out of drinking water. In fact, quite the opposite. If you boil this kind of contaminated water, you concentrate the harmful chemicals in it because the water is gone.
That is new information to me.
you can thank my interest in prepper culture for knowing that.
I thought I always call myself a liberal prepper, but I am now newly informed.
You can filter heavy metals like lead and particulates like silt and sand out of water, but you can't filter out chemicals like chloroform. As far as water treatment goes, the operation of modern industrial treatment facilities is paramount to providing the safest possible source of potable water. You simply can't treat everything at the top. Caroline, let me ask you a question. Do you know what a municipal bond is?
I don't want to admit that I don't.
I didn't either.
It's some kind of safer way of storing your money, right? I mean, it's a municipal bond is a, you know, bonds are safer than stocks, and municipal bonds are, I'm assuming, some municipally oriented iteration of a savings bond.
I love how you don't know what it is, but you took exactly what it is and you know exactly what it is. Like, you took the words and you were like, this must be what it is, and you described it perfectly. So cities will sell bonds,
okay,
and they'll use the revenue from the bonds to fund infrastructure projects. And this is not new. And so this is where we have to now talk about American infrastructure. First off, it's failing, and we need to understand why we say it's failing.
American infrastructure is failing?
Yes.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's just falling apart. It gets older. The infrastructure gets older the further east you go, and also the farther south you go. In the 1800s, New England undertook huge infrastructure projects like canals, railroads, dams, and reservoirs, and they were made possible with municipal bonds. The cities would sell bonds for, say, a new reservoir project or a new dam. Those were loans taken out by cities from banks and used on these service projects. Cities are cities, and cities are not construction companies. So when a municipal bond was taken out, the money is funneled to private companies responsible for all the project's logistics. So city like New York, they take out a bond and they pay a company to build the Erie Canal. This canal, just for reference, connects Lake Erie to the Hudson River and the Atlantic Ocean. This was a major milestone for American infrastructure. And this is important because New York's financing of the Erie Canal project was such a huge success. The canal tolls paid for construction in the first year that this was like a proof of concept for municipal bonds to fund other major infrastructure projects. So this became how infrastructure in America got started. So those are municipal bonds. The second part of infrastructure. Are you familiar? Have you ever heard of government charter corporations? You can probably use your context clues and deductive reasoning to figure this one out too.
I mean, I would assume that they are corporations that have been received financial backing from the government in order to manifest themselves in the world.
This is...
Is that right?
Perfectly stated, yes. So government chartered corporations...
I feel terrible that I can't just reel off. I'm sure that my eighth grade social studies teacher would be disappointed in me. I'm sure he taught me this. I was taught this. Anyone who's listening to this who educated me, I don't mean to disrespect you by not remembering. I'm sorry.
I will share with you a quick secret. I knew what municipal bonds and... the government charter corporations were, because I've read about this a lot in the past. But when I was writing this episode, I had to go back and look them up because I do not retain information very well.
That makes me feel bad.
Yeah. So, good. So government charter corporations, those are the private companies that are officially contracted for the construction of these projects. Union Pacific Railroad should be a name that we all recognize that started as a government chartered corporation. These are privately held corporations with a limited charter, and typically they exist for the duration of a construction project. So they're dissolved after the project is over. So the people, for the people making money from government charters, it would be great if they could keep making money without the government interfering. And through a lot of lawsuits, ultimately the corporation became a person. Cool. Corporate personhood. That's because of, yeah, long story short. All right, so municipal bonds paid for government chartered corporations to build infrastructure projects, including, and perhaps most importantly, water supply projects. Reservoirs and dams and in-ground pipes require a lot of maintenance, and in the 1800s, it was most common for the government chartered corporation to hold the contract for maintenance, distribution, and billing. In short, America's water was privatized from the start. This eventually got turned over. Most municipalities that had private water companies, that charter expired, and then the municipality took over, usually with their own waterworks department or kind of subcontracting that out. However, this is a problem. Government charters are essentially sanctioned monopolies. And in the case of privately held utilities, the utility itself became a commodity subject to price hikes, poor regulation, or oversight, and like all commodities, in danger of becoming a product accessible only to the well-to-do. Equitable and comprehensive distribution of utilities to wealthy and poor alike was not guaranteed. The switch from private water companies to public waterworks happened gradually but definitively. In 1800, less than 10% of waterworks services were publicly owned. By 1924, 70% of the water supply was publicly owned. Municipalities could provide water and service infrastructure equitably among all citizens simply by charging nominal rates to keep up with maintenance and expansion. Now, there are some key factors that I want to go over real quick. Health, sanitation, and fire department service. The push for publicly owned water supply and wastewater treatment was predicated on the idea that private companies simply provided better service all around because they were not bound by the desire for profits. However, private waterworks more commonly use water filtration systems than public utilities. An outbreak of waterborne epidemics in the late 1800s saw no correlation between public or private supplies, and the largest city fires in America's history, New York in 1845, Pittsburgh 1845, St. Louis 1849, Chicago 1870, I'm just going to keep going, Chicago 1871, 1874, Boston 1872, and Baltimore 1902, all huge city fires, all of these occurred in cities with public waterworks. So, the most meaningful argument for public instead of private waterworks is democratization, meaning everyone within a municipality has access to clean water and wastewater management. Water is fundamental to life. I don't want to beat a dead horse, but you know, hydration, hygiene, cooking, cleaning, any statement other than water is a human right is not made in good faith. Water is vital to human dignity. And now finally, we can focus.
Is that your line?
Yes.
Any statement other than water is vital to human life is not
made in good faith.
Made in good faith. That's so good.
Thanks.
Congratulations. I love that line.
Sometimes I do words
it's
good.
It's really good. It's really good. Carry on.
No, that actually means a lot to me. Thank you. But now we can finally move on to Jackson, Mississippi. Guess what, Caroline? Everything that we just talked about is all relevant, and it wasn't just a tangent, because usually I just ramble and it's all nonsense.
Is water not public in Mississippi? Water's private in Mississippi.
In a lot of places.
And it's broken.
It is.
And black people don't get any? Yeah.
Not in Jackson. So you lived in Mississippi for a while, right?
5 years.
I only lived there for 1 year. Did you ever get a water boil notice? where you lived?
My only answer to that question is that I might have, but I don't remember one. But receiving information from the government was not something that was like the most linear or accessible circumstance in my life when I lived in Mississippi. So I very well could have received, in air quotes, a notification from the government. I have no idea is the answer to the question.
I'm going to tell you a quick story before I go into the story of Jackson. So we lived in Hattiesburg for a year. And there was a night when I went to turn on the water for a shower or Willa's bath or something. And brown water just started coming out of the faucet. And it was horrible. But we also heard a lot of sirens. And then the next day we got a boil water notice like taped to our front door. And apparently, first off, it was super weird going to Hattiesburg because when you have to go get your water turned on, you have to go to the waterworks. And it was just like this shitty concrete block building with like a window in it. And I was like, this is a really weird, like, I can't believe the city, I didn't realize it was privately owned. I was like, the city can't afford like a proper building for their water department. Well, no, it's because it's privately owned and they're not going to spend the money on anything. So they have all these reservoirs. And when there's a fire, the fire department hooks up to, you know, a fire hydrant, and it sucks so much water out of the system that it actually starts to pull directly from the reservoir, and it fills all the domestic water lines with sand and silt from the reservoir because it's pumping so much water out. So you have to run your water to clear out the lines. And then if you're going to drink it for a period of time, like 24 hours, they send out the boil notices. So this is what Hattiesburg water infrastructure is like. And it's the same story across Mississippi where the water is private. Would you like to express your thoughts on that? Because your face is telling me a whole lot.
I'm just worried about my health.
Yeah.
Is what I'm contemplating as I'm absorbing that. It wearies you the ways in which the vanity of the people who created the infrastructure of this country just thought, oh, well, if you leave it to individual state governments, they'll just do the right thing by the people. And then we're sitting here in 2024 wondering whether or not we've given ourselves any number of conditions and diseases by just drinking the water that these nice men who created these infrastructures set up a system that put that water into our bodies. It's just bewildering. So I'm just looking backward and worrying.
I'm going to get into this a little bit later in the episode, but one of the things that popped out, they kept mentioning lead in water, and it didn't occur to me until maybe halfway through writing the episode, and I just started thinking, like, why the fuck is there lead in water? Where the fuck is it coming from? Because we've never used lead water pipes. That's not a thing. Now, the Romans used lead water pipes, which is interesting. The Romans did, I think. Anyway, apparently the calcium deposit or the mineral, it doesn't matter. The mineral deposits in the water lined the lead and they didn't get lead poisoning, but it doesn't matter. But the lead comes from how, like, your water pipes in your house are actually soldered together because some of the solder contains lead. But they also use some types of metal have a lead component to them, but it's not used specifically for like water supplies. It's all in the fittings and connections. Now, one could argue that once we have the scientific data to say that lead is harmful, you'd have a bunch of people like, oh, we should do some sort of program to get lead out of our home. Nope. Now we have this whole thing about lead paint. We don't sell lead paint anymore, but you can still buy lead is in a lot of stuff.
But it's very expensive to fix the plumbing.
Yes, it is. And we just don't have the money for that. We just don't have it. Okay.
We find the money and we just have to spend that money on people in the hospital instead.
Whew. All right. So now back to Jackson. In 1888, the city of Jackson, Mississippi used municipal bonds and granted a corporate charter to the Light, Heat, and Water Company of Jackson for the erection of a public school building and associated utilities, as well as providing a clean supply of water to the city and fire hydrant locations. Now, this contract had everything. It had an 8-mile section of water mains, tie-ins for businesses and private residences, and a 20-year service contract that guaranteed constant clean supply of water for the entire duration. The contract was also quite specific, calling out water pressure requirements and pump flow requirements, 2 million gallons a day. In 1908, the 20-year contract was up, and the city of Jackson purchased the water rights from the Light, Heat, and Water Company of Jackson. Back then, the population of Jackson was between 8 and 10,000 residents, and eventually the 2 million gallons a day wasn't enough. The construction of the J.H. Fuel Water Treatment Plant in 1914 doubled the service of Jackson's water system, capable of providing 4 million gallons a day along 500 miles of in-ground water mains. Up until 1970, the vast majority of in-ground water pipes were cast iron, cheap, easy to form, easy to place. But cast iron is also quite stiff, brittle, and it rusts, like a lot. Like any amount of water on cast iron will leave behind a superficial layer of oxidation. Any prolonged exposure to water, say a leak from a faulty joint, will cause heavier rust to form, which will then eat at the cast iron structure. That's bad enough. But cast iron is so brittle because it is very rigid. It has no flex to it. Most steel or iron alloys have some amount of flex, but not cast iron. If you've ever cracked a cast iron pan, you're aware that cast iron is durable, but brittle. Now, if you live in most any other city or state in the U.S., cast iron pipes aren't so bad. Many are still in service. But in Jackson, Mississippi, the use of cast iron was an exceptionally poor choice thanks to the specific type of soil it's buried in.
Alluvial?
I think so, but it's specifically called Yazoo clay in Mississippi.
Right, yeah, there you go, sorry.
But I think you're right. Yazoo clay is mostly free of impurities such as sand and silt, which would normally allow for better absorption of water. Because of this, dry Yazoo clay acts like one of those spongy dinosaurs that we used to play with that's in the little pill and then mm-hmm. it gets big. It absorbs water, puffs up, and then starts seeping water. As the ground freezes and thaws, as it dries and moistens, the Yazoo clay is constantly heaving and sucking, shrinking and growing. If you spent any time driving through Mississippi, you may have noticed that many of the old roads look like roller coasters. They really fucking suck. They're also constantly repairing them. They're also notorious for getting huge potholes in them. Yazoo clay is responsible for structural damage in buildings, the failure of roadbeds, and for exerting extreme forces on Jackson's brittle cast iron water mains. So, combine the heaving Yazoo clay soil with cast iron, and you get leaks and breakage. Then, consider the ease with which cast iron rusts, and it should be no surprise that Jackson's water infrastructure was doomed from its inception in 1888. It is the civil engineering equivalent of the Ouroboros. I wrote that, and I think I wrote that for you, but because my memory is so bad, what is the Ouroboros?
What is the Ouroboros? The snake that eats its own tail.
That's right. Oh, fuck.
Come on now. Are you kidding me? I thought you were teeing that up for me. Of course. Oh, man. Sci-fi nerd or fantasy nerd. I don't even know. Mythology nerd. All of the things. Yeah. Snake that eats his own tail.
That is the danger of writing something like months ago and not reading it again.
That's brilliant. It is an Ouroboros. It eats itself. It built a system, a self-canceling system.
In the 21st century, with climate change bringing annual record-breaking cold snaps in the winter, Mississippi's water infrastructure is failing at an exponential rate. It is bad and getting worse. It is, in short, a clusterfuck. Arguably, there is no way that engineers in the 1880s could have predicted the impact climate change would have had on Jackson's water system. They probably also couldn't have predicted that 140 years later, there would still be cast iron in the ground. But Mississippi's current government doesn't need to predict the future. It just needs to turn a compassionate eye towards Jackson's citizenry. Unfortunately, the state legislature appears to be going out of its way to bring maximum suffering to Jackson's 83% black population. So this is where, in the episode, the Jackson water crisis, this is where everything comes together. This is the intersection of race, climate, infrastructure, and politics. And this, not just the water being an ingredient in you liking food, but this is why I wanted to talk specifically to you, Caroline. I don't like spelling things out for listeners, but for this specific topic, the history of infrastructure is just as important as what's happening today. I will get into details, but I do want to ask you, knowing what you know, we discussed at the beginning of the episode about Jackson's water crisis, just hearing what you've heard, what we've been through right now, knowing that Jackson is predominantly black, and this is also the seat of government for the state of Mississippi, which is the representatives are majority white. I'm just wondering in general what your thoughts are on where this is going, where you see this going, or any kind of experience or insight you might have at this point before we get too far into the politics of this episode.
With my opening gesture to be to name and claim my relative amateur level of insight into this crisis, I think that from what you've laid out, and from what I understand of my own lived experience in Mississippi and my own sense of the ways in which America is historically dysfunctional when it comes to serving predominantly Black communities, especially in the South. What I think when what I'm thinking about when I contemplate your question is that I'm a little bit heartbroken at the outset, because what I am sure of is that people do not historically throw money at problems that only affect Black people. And so it doesn't really matter if the central seat of government is in Jackson. Everybody has like a condo or like a little apartment in the one fancy high rise in town, and their real house is 45 minutes out of town, another county, another district. They're not concerned. The people of Jackson will suffer, and the people in power will remain unbothered. And they will talk about historical they'll talk about historical integrity of the system, of the pipes. They'll talk about how precious it is that we've had those same cast iron pipes with their lead, and how interesting that is, and how we need to figure out how to conserve those things which are ancient and historical and of some sort of ideological value in that dimension and description. And the people who are adversely affected in terms of their health on a profound and practical and fiscal level don't have the money to actually advocate for themselves to actually argue that point. And so I think that probably they will be overcome and underserved indefinitely is is what I think when I hear you ask me that question.
This is an excellent part for us to take a tangent. In full disclosure for our listeners, I did send Caroline this episode before we did it, and but I asked her not to prepare for the episode. And so she does not know how this story plays out, but I think it says a lot about how transparent we are as a society that Caroline has essentially hit the nail on the fucking head.
Wait, really?
Yeah. The only exception is I have not heard. Somebody may have said, but nobody has said that we need to preserve the water pipes because they're historic. But
I bet we can find somebody who said
it. I guarantee you. But everything that's about to happen in Jackson, politically and with the infrastructure and everything, it is going to line up with everything that you just said. And this is where things get horrible, considering that we are talking about something so vital to human life as water. Like,
it's comforting to me though to know that I was right, because it makes you be able to actually plan for the future, because you can go, okay, I know how this is going to go, so I'm going to make some other plan.
Perfect.
It just keeps your eyes clear. Yeah. And on the prize about looking forward.
So currently, Jackson's 150,000 residents are without regular access to clean drinking water. And this is today. There have been some improvements, but 150,000 residents, they are still having issues in 2024 with getting regular access to clean drinking water. There is currently a class action lawsuit of some 1,000 residents against the city and the state for lead-contaminated drinking water. And the response from the state has been to deny responsibility and to blame the city itself for its infrastructure problems. And the thing is, the entire history of Jackson's water infrastructure has been plagued with problems, from deferred maintenance to boil notices to misappropriation of funds. But the state's current stance is one of collective punishment. Because city leaders failed to serve its citizens, the citizens must suffer. So let's talk about that. April 2015 also saw a strange but telling battle between the mayor of Jackson, Tony Yarber, and the Jackson City Council, amid an onslaught of broken water mains, destroyed roads, and the failure of a pump at the O.B. Curtis Water Treatment Plant following heavy rains. Mayor Yarber declared a state of emergency in the city of Jackson. Hoping to receive emergency funding from the state, the city council voted overwhelmingly against the emergency decree. Now, it's important to note that Tony Yarber is Black, and the city council was majority Black, with Councilman Melvin Priester saying that the emergency decree might set the wrong precedent if the city council was declaring potholes and busted water pipes an emergency. That city council vote meant that the governor's office wouldn't recognize the need for repairs, which meant Jackson would not be eligible for federal funding. Later that year, August 2015, heavy rains inundated Jackson, leading to water main breaks and several road failures. On August 11, 2015, Mississippi Public Broadcasting canceled a screening of its documentary, Rising Above the Surge, the Post-Katrina Coast, due to loss of water service. I don't have any fucking thing to say about that because it's so fucking absurd and so fucking fitting that a documentary on the climate catastrophe and blatant racism in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina would be canceled due to climate change impacting another Black community. That is something out of a fucking Coen Brothers movie, is what that is. It is like that part right there. Like I could not come up with that in a million years if I wanted to. So let's fast forward just a bit, because in 2021, this is actually really good. I really like this. Okay. In 2021, when Jackson was going through its latest water crisis, former Mayor Tony Yarbrough, who wanted to declare an emergency but was voted down by a city council, took to Facebook to remind the people of Jackson that he had sought a state emergency for the city, but the city council and then Governor Phil Bryant did nothing to help. This was his Facebook post. Quote, "Y'all remember when I declared an emergency for the city's water infrastructure in 2015? You remember the one city council overturned and then governor didn't act on and most of y'all laughed at? Okay, welp, go on back to your hobaths." That is fucking perfect.
I love Mississippi. No. It's what is it? Barry Hanna. Great Mississippi writer, a white Mississippi writer. He said, "The Deep South may be wretched, but it can howl." And that is, this whole circumstance is a manifestation of that quote.
Former Mayor Yarbrough's Facebook statement was perfect. Absolutely on point, no notes. So let's go back to 2015. That was the same year that water sampling in Jackson discovered that 22% of Jackson households had lead-contaminated water, far exceeding federal action levels. Hinds County, where Jackson is, has the highest number of children in the state with elevated blood lead levels. Now, remember we discussed difference between contaminants, biological and chemical. When water mains break, untreated water can enter the water lines and the city will issue a boil notice. When you discover lead in your water, no amount of boiling will remove the lead. You have to get bottled water. So Jackson, Mississippi has a water crisis on multiple levels: degrading infrastructure, untreated water that needs to be boiled, and contaminated water that is completely unsafe to drink. So from 2021 to 2023, the city of Jackson issued over 300 boil water notices and reported more than 7,300 line breaks. The problems keep compounding. Let's move on. So, what does it take to fix this mess? Obviously, Jackson's water infrastructure is broken. Like Flint, the only actual way to fix the problem is money. A shitload of money. And the whole thing, from reservoirs and pumps and filtration systems to the main lines running through the city to the individual service lines feeding each home and business, they all need to be replaced. This is a tear it out and start over kind of issue. You cannot piecemeal your way through it. Because since 1888, the combination of brittle cast iron, Yazoo clay, and deferred maintenance have left the city with unusable infrastructure. Money is the problem, and here is something frustrating. There is less regulation and hem-hawing over sending tens of billions of dollars to Israel and Ukraine than there is over providing the city of Jackson with the $2 billion a total infrastructure replacement would cost. As it is, the city of Jackson cannot foot the bill on its own, and the Mississippi State Legislature and Governor's Office place the blame solely on Jackson's leadership. And it's the legislature and governor holding those funds away from the city of Jackson. We're going to get to this in a minute. Mississippi has $2 billion for infrastructure, specifically because of this. Jackson isn't getting it. We're going to get to that in a bit. Yeah. Let's talk about race, because as a Southern white guy who is meant to be canceled, I can afford it. I'm fine.
The condition of your life is on is on trial at the moment.
Yes, it's true.
And within, like, in Western society.
And I am okay with that. As a Southern white guy, this next section, just bear with me here. It'll all come together in a minute. Every single tactic used by the state of Mississippi to deny the city of Jackson funds is definitely what racist Southern white guys would do. Now, I have a sixth sense about these things because of how I was raised. And the reason I'm giving you this long intro is to demonstrate that, yes, white people can be racist towards a whole ass place. Not just the people there, but like the whole fucking place. And Carolina, because I can be canceled and it's okay, I need to use my mouth to put out words that I don't think I've ever actually said out loud myself. They are offensive and I am going to apologize. And they are demonstrations that white people can be racist towards whole ass places. The first, and you've probably heard of it, is the nickname that white people have for Memphis.
Memphrica.
There you go. That's gross.
My friend's white brother told me it when I was in middle school and he thought it was so funny. I'll never forget. It was awful.
Of course he did. The second is the nickname for Atlanta traffic. The Watermelon 500. I had not heard that ever.
Ugh.
Right? Isn't it? And it came out of the guy's mouth so casual. Like, how'd you like the Watermelon 500? And I was like sitting there like, what the fuck is this guy talking about? And then I was like,
good grief.
I don't know. And he was like, yeah, I hate driving through Atlanta. I was like, what the? Oh, so I want to make it clear. I want to make it clear that both of these nicknames came to me from older Southern white guys. And that is the very same demographic running the state of Mississippi. So
that's right.
I'm going to give you a brief timeline along with some commentary, and we're going to get to the bottom of all of this. Is it possible that Mississippi's government is racist against its largest city, which also happens to be majority black?
Yes.
You are correct. You are correct. Yes, it is possible. 100%. Let's discuss how that's possible. All right. So in 2021, Mississippi's Lieutenant Governor Delbert Hoseman, which, by the way, here's what you need to know about Mississippi politics. All the white dudes have the weirdest fucking names.
Preposterous.
Delbert Hoseman, in discussing Jackson's water crisis with a reporter from Mississippi Free Press, asked the reporter a rhetorical question. Quote, "You remember during Kane Ditto's administration? He did repair work on water and sewer. So what happened since then?" End quote. Now, for context, Ditto was the last white mayor of Jackson. So
when was that?
That's a good question.
Was that like a Nixonian circumstance?
No, this was in the 90s. I think it was 95 or 96.
Oh.
But don't worry, because he's not right. All right. So what's the takeaway from that other than saying that the reason the infrastructure is failing because of black leadership? And the thing is, Hoseman is conveniently leaving out crucial context. Following Ditto Kane's administration, Harvey Johnson Jr. was the first black mayor of Jackson. And during his 12-year administration, the city spent over $200 million on water and sewer improvements alone. So, responding directly to Hoseman's comment, former Mayor Harvey Johnson clarified, quote, "In my administration, we put up two new water storage tanks, came from under an EPA-imposed consent decree on our oldest water treatment plant where it was discharging into the Pearl River. We were able to direct that. It cost $10 million to $12 million just to do that." End quote. All right, so I forgot. There's also another major issue with the water infrastructure in Jackson, and I'm so sorry. This one will be quick. Billing. The water billing in Jackson is broken. You have the meters in front of your house, and the water company comes, and they read the meters, and they charge you for what you've consumed that month, and the sewer fee is usually a flat rate. All that shit's fucked in Jackson. Back in 2010, the city of Jackson began exploring automated metering systems. In 2013, the city signed a $90 million contract with the Siemens Corporation. They are an Internet of Things technology solutions company that does a little bit of everything, from healthcare equipment to water meters. The proposal was to bring Jackson's water metering up to date, but Siemens botched the job and left the metering and billing system in worse shape than when they got there. Some Jackson residents don't even receive bills, and some residents get random monthly bills in the thousands or tens of thousands of dollars. I believe one woman in Jackson got a bill for $30,000 for her like two-bedroom home. So fast forward to 2020, and the city of Jackson finally settled with Siemens out of court for $89.8 million. That doesn't mean a whole lot. So here's the whole scope of the problem. In February 2020, Jackson Public Works Director Bob Miller told the Jackson Free Press that the city had, quote, 34,804 active water and sewer customer accounts with outstanding balances over $100 that are in arrear over 30 days. The total for unpaid water bills, $43,541,000 something. All right. Here's the kicker. In the system that Siemens proposed, the combination of a specific meter and specific billing system, was one that Siemens had never implemented before. Jackson, Mississippi paid $90 million for an untested system that left them with $43 million in unpaid contested billings. They royally fucked up Jackson, as far as billing goes. There's another component to this, and that's the assertion by current mayor Chokwe Lumumba that Siemens resold their meters. This is also fucked up. Siemens resold their meters to Jackson Middleman, essentially jacking up the price per meter so that intermediaries could get some of Jackson's money. So Siemens came into town. They found basically brokers. They sold, instead of selling the meters directly to Jackson, they sold them to a third party who then sold them to Jackson, and then they jacked up the price so Jackson is not getting all they can for their money. All that being said, surely the state of Mississippi would take Jackson's side in all this, right? After all, they got fleeced, right? No.
Why on earth would they do that? The state of Mississippi is run by wealthy white people.
This is true.
And Jackson is black people. So the state of Mississippi wouldn't take Jackson's side, right?
You are correct. You are correct. But it's worse than you think.
Well, it's always worse.
In 2021, just a few years ago, the state legislature denied a proposal bill that would increase local sales tax from 1% to 2%. We're going to get into that in a minute. That's important. But they denied the request, and Governor Tate Reeves' response was that Jackson needed to fix its problem with its billing system before, quote, asking everyone else to pony it more money, end quote. So they'd already put up the money to do it. Siemens fucked it up, and then the governor was like, you really need to fix that. And they're like, we don't have the money. You fucked us up.
Can I just pause here and say that when I was a public school teacher for the state of Mississippi, I was given $280 a year of money to spend on my classroom. $280 a year. And just to be clear, that was a classroom that had a hole in the ceiling, a gas heater also on the ceiling that had fire to heat it, and no textbooks, and I had 86 students, and I was paid $31,500 a year. So before taxes. So just all of that to say, like, the state of Mississippi and their allocation of funds and whether or not they have money and the ways that they ask people to spend money on shit before they're willing to dole it out, like, it's preposterous. And I've been a state employee of the state of Mississippi, and they don't pay, and it doesn't make any sense. I'm just going to name that right now.
Caroline, sometimes I'm not good with words. What's that one word for when someone is taking the domineering or fatherly role in a relationship, but it's just abusive? Is there a word for that?
Oh, do you mean a misogyny? Patriarchy?
Like, yeah, there you go. Yeah, there you go. That might be it. Those fit. Yeah, that's what this relationship is. It's horrible. They're just doing shitty stuff. So now let's talk about something super boring, and that is local sales tax. And trust me, it's okay. Mississippi's statewide sales tax is 7%, and each municipality, city, or county can opt in to an additional maximum 1% local sales tax. That's how the state works. And that additional 1% local sales tax goes towards whatever the city or county wants. In 2011, the Mississippi State Legislature passed a resolution allowing Jackson to add that 1% sales tax. So they went from 0 to 1%, essentially an infrastructure tax for roads, bridges, and water. 2014, the city of Jackson voted to levy the tax in a referendum. Since it's been in place, it has raised over $120 million. That's $120 million over not quite a decade. And that money has gone where Jackson said it would, repairing roads, bridges, and waterworks as the funds are available. So they're using the tax money, the addition, that 1%, they're using it exactly how they said they would. Exactly.
Yeah, but the like rich white people of Mississippi that are paying that tax don't care about whether or not it's serving Jackson, right?
That's the thing. Jackson is only charging it in Jackson. That 1% is coming from the people of Jackson. So they would later vote to raise it an additional 1%, but the governor said
that
no.
That sounds so lovely.
Doesn't it?
Oh my gosh.
That way, it's, yeah. So way back in February 2023, not a year ago, State Rep Trey Lamar, he represents parts of Lafayette and Tate counties, and he sits on the state Ways
I've
and
I've lived
Means
in
committee.
Lafayette County.
Is it nice?
I've lived in Lafayette County.
State Rep Trey Lamar on the State Ways and Means Committee introduced House Bill 1168, which explicitly restricts the use of Jackson's 1% local tax for water infrastructure only, stating, quote, I feel like ability to have fresh, clean drinking water and not have sewage running on top of the roads at this point in time is a higher priority than paving potholes, end quote. So the thing is, they're using the potholes again. They're talking about infrastructure, but instead of, you know, saying, yes, you can use that on water, they're saying, well, we're not going to, you can't use it on potholes. All right, so whatever. That's great and all, but just keep in mind that Lamar represents Lafayette and Tate counties, not Hinds County. And just for the record, those counties are not even near Jackson. They are not touching.
Lafayette is, I'll just be clear, Lafayette is where the University of Mississippi is. I lived in Lafayette County when I studied at the University of Mississippi. That's where Oxford is. It's a purple county, I would say. Magenta.
It's got heavily.
It has a whiff of blue.
Perfect.
Okay.
So now let's move on to the money. Do you remember how COVID ruined everything?
Continues to ruin.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's been 2020 for 4 years.
That's correct.
Anyway, Biden sure remembers how COVID ruined everything. In 2021, Congress passed the American Rescue Plan Act. That is a $1.9 trillion stimulus fund to speed up the nation's recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic. Out of that $1.9 trillion, the state of Mississippi received $1.8 billion, but Mississippi decided to allocate 10%, $180 million, to water systems for the entire state. Of that $180 million, Jackson, Mississippi has been granted $36 million, and there are conditions. Mississippi's legislature imposed extra oversight on the ARPA funds for Jackson and for no other jurisdiction. Any money awarded to the city has to be kept in a fund controlled by the state treasury, overseen by both the Department of Finance and Administration and Department of Environmental Quality. No other city or county in Jackson has that kind of oversight. The ARPA grant money was a one-to-one grant made possible by the Mississippi Municipality and County Water and Infrastructure Grant Program for matching project funds. So the cumulative grant total is $71 million. That is still far short of the $1 billion price tag for completely repairing Jackson's water infrastructure, and in fact, it doesn't go very far. The allocated funds have already been earmarked. $1.65 million for raw water treatment, $1.45 million for chemical feed automation, $2.75 million for general pump repair, $4.4 million for Mill Street sewer basin reconstruction, $9.2 million for general filter rehab, repair, and replacement, $11.7 million for West Bank interceptor rehab and sewer repair and reconstruction, $3.85 million for general filter rehab, repair, and replacement. They've marked all the funds up. They have exactly where it's going. It still does not fix the problem. There is no funds there to fix the metering problem, the billing problem. It's too expensive. And there's no funds for basic infrastructure like replacing old cast iron or backfilling Yazoo clay trenches. Oh, I forgot to mention. Do you know how you fix the Yazoo clay problem? You dig out a trench in the thing, and then you just backfill it with gravel. And the gravel makes up for how it swells and stuff because the gravel will move around the pipe. It doesn't It moves around it helps with, that's all you have to do. Dig a trench, put gravel in it. There you go.
That seems inexpensive.
It is. Gravel is super cheap. It's called engineered backfill. It's just gravel. Now, an interesting thing happened during the 2021 Jackson mayoral debate. Mayor Lumumba recounted an exchange he had with Lieutenant Governor Delbert Hoseman when asked about fixing Jackson's water infrastructure. Lumumba said, quote, "I sat down with the Lieutenant Governor to talk about Jackson's infrastructure problem. We had a conversation that lasted for about an hour and a half, and he asked everyone to leave the room only to say, 'Mayor, I need you to give me my airport, and I look at it for about $30 million. So not only am I supposed to be dumb, I'm supposed to be cheap, right?'" End quote. Hey, apropos of nothing, let's talk real quick about that airport. We're talking about the Jackson Medgar Wiley Evers International Airport, which up until 2016 was governed by the 5-member board of Jackson Municipal Airport Authority. These are a lot of things that nobody knew existed. Those are all local Jackson positions, all black. In 2016, the state legislature passed House Bill 2162, which essentially stole the airport from the Jackson board and replaced it with a board of 9, with only 2 spots open for Jackson representatives. Now, that seems bad. But it's actually worse than that, because the Jackson Airport provides revenue to the city of Jackson. The new 9-member board would divert that money out of Hinds County and Jackson, majority black, and into neighboring Rankin and Madison counties. They're mostly white counties. The airport revenue is yet another key component to solving Jackson's infrastructure crisis. They need the airport for more money to fix their infrastructure problems. Those dates, they don't line up, though. The bill was passed in 2016. Lumumba was talking about a conversation with Lieutenant Governor Hoseman in 2021. Well, that's because the airport drama has been tied up in federal courts for the last 7 years. It wasn't until June of last year, 2023, that the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed that the takeover would result in concrete damages because the board members would lose their benefits. That's it. They would lose their benefits. Not because that. Anyway, yeah. However, the legal battle has not been about benefits. The legal battle has been about racism, explicitly stated in Jackson's appeal, and the literal stealing of much-needed funds from the city. However, the courts have refused to hear the racism argument, stating that there is no ground to claim or prove it. When attorneys for the airport authority sought to subpoena communications from lawmakers specifically about the bill in order to show racial bias, a magistrate ruled that those communications were protected by legislative privilege or white privilege. Last thing I'm going to say on the airport thing. During that same mayoral debate, the sole Republican candidate, white dude Ponto Downing, Ponto Downing, who calls himself a, quote, Tate Reeves Republican, said he could solve Jackson's water crisis in one fell swoop. Quote, I can get $470 million. Real simple way to do that. Sell the airport. Simple. Be nice. Comply with Tate Reeves, who is the governor. End quote. That is white dude talk for stop being uppity and do what you're told. That is how that is. Do you interpret it different? Because that's what it seems to me. Where are we at right now?
I'm rendered speechless because I'm sort of processing. I lived in Mississippi from 2010 to 2015. So sort of at the beginning of the unfolding of this new wave of catastrophes that you're talking about. And it's funny. I mean, let me just say, I never flew out of Jackson. I flew out of Memphis. Well, for a number of reasons. What I will say that is useful in this conversation is that I have a tremendous respect for Black people who are trying to navigate municipal elected obligations in spaces that have really profound white power adversarial structures that they're trying to figure out how to get as much as they can for the people they represent. And the kinds of compromise that you make when you are a Black person in power, with small power, in a state that has really big white power, I think you can make big mistakes that are really with good intention. And that's not an excuse, but it's also, we're too in the midst of the history of all of this kind of thing to know what's right or wrong. You know, do you give somebody the airport to get the money? I actually don't know. 470 is much closer to the amount that is needed,
yeah.
Right? Because you said the amount that's needed is one point something billion dollars, right? And so Ponto is saying he can get half the money instead of some like a tenth of it.
Yeah.
And what he wants is a selling of the soul.
But here's the other thing about Ponto, because he's the Republican.
I mean, Ponto sounds like a nightmare.
He's a piece of shit.
Yeah.
The only reason, this guy had no chance of winning Jackson's mayoral race. Conservative Republican white guy in Jackson running against the incumbent. They've had Black mayors since the mid-90s. There was no way he was going to win. It really seems like the only reason that he was there was to bring up the airport against Lumumba to say, you could fix all this shit if you would just sell the airport. And then he just basically peaced out because he was a white dude who was never going to get elected, but he put it out basically in the public record. You could do, that's what it seems like to me. That's like a different level of...
The question then becomes, what does it mean that he's shaming this Black mayor who is trying to stand up for what is needed? By saying, well, if you just gave up this one thing, and he makes the compromise look reasonable. But then even in the midst of that conversation, he's only offering half of what is actually required. Like, it is such an active, like, hamstringing of advancement for the needs of the Black people of that city. And it's like, it's just farcical because it's like, I'm going to shame this Black man who's like, actually doing the work, but I'm going to shame him by offering more than what he's got and still not enough and try to make him look bad with that. It's like there is something so ugly about that it is head spinning.
There's also the component that the suggestion is that if they just sell, they'll get that money like no strings attached. It has been proven to this point, every single time there's money involved, the state is going to control it when it comes to tax.
100% that, but also give up your airport. I mean, that's such a giant sacrifice.
Yeah.
I mean, that is its own giant strings attached.
And then, just considering that the revenue from the airport is actually for that county, and it's then going to serve other county.
The fact that Mississippi is so underserved when it comes to like modern transportation, that's why it's a difficult place to choose to live unless you have profound wealth or you're living in such a rural and removed circumstance that it doesn't make a difference whether or not you have access to the rest of the world.
It is so frustrating to read about how they're just playing with this. It's like a toy, just back and forth. It's cruel. So, all right, where do we stand with the water in Jackson? Last year, 2020, or 2 years ago, 2022, things were really bad in Jackson. 150,000 people without clean drinking water, contaminated water, sewage overflow to busted pipes. That's the entire city of Jackson without water surface. And since then, things have gotten better, from regular boil water notices and unpredictable service to now, to December 2023, service has been restored and the water is safer. So key points as to what's happened over the last year, and this is straight from the EPA's website. Flooding in Mississippi in early August 2022 caused the city of Jackson's already vulnerable public water system to lack sufficient pressure in some areas, leaving about 150,000 residents without drinkable water. August 30, 2022, emergencies were declared by the mayor, the governor, the Mississippi State Department of Health, and the president. The city was under a state-imposed boil water notice for 40 days, ending September 16, 2022. Multiple federal, state, and local partners responded, making progress in restoring water pressure and repairing equipment. However, the city needed more time to address staffing shortages, operations, and maintenance issues, and needed infrastructure repairs. In December 2022, a severe cold snap reduced ambient temperatures to well below freezing for 48 hours. Once again, the city lost pressure to thousands of customers, and a precautionary citywide boil water notice was issued. There continues to be an imminent danger that the system could fail again and return to boil water notice without improved management, operation, and maintenance of the system. That's everything we've covered in the episode up to now. This is what we were leading up to, the 2022 water crisis. Drastic steps were taken, huge progress made. On November 29, 2022, the U.S. Department of Justice filed a lawsuit on behalf of the EPA charging that Jackson violated the Safe Drinking Water Act, failure to provide safe drinking water. At the same time, a proposal was filed in federal court to appoint a third-party manager to stabilize Jackson's water system. So here we go, because it's about to get better. It has to get worse before it gets better. So, a federal court appointed a third-party manager to stabilize Jackson's water system. This is a proposed stipulated order meant to act as an interim measure while the named parties come to a legally binding consent decree. Okay, whatever. One day later, November 30th, 2022, Mayor Lumumba released a statement, and I am just going to read the opening paragraph. After months of collaboration with the U.S. Department of Justice, the Mississippi Department of Health, and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the City of Jackson is pleased that we have finally reached an agreement that represents a critical next step in our efforts to provide immediate and long-term solutions for Jackson's water crisis. I appreciate that the City Council and Honorable Judge Henry T. Wingate signed off on the interim stipulated order in one accord with my administration. Ted Hennepin has been appointed as the water system's third-party administrator, and we have enjoyed building a working relationship with him since the start of the emergency. Mr. Hennepin has been instrumental in lending his expertise to our recovery thus far. Okay, so if that was kind of hard to follow, bunch of lawsuits, taken to court, federal judge appoints Ted Hennepin to oversee Jackson's water system. And this is actually a good thing. Ted Hennepin is the man of the hour, and Jackson residents seem to actually like him. Judge Henry Wingate held a 30-day public comment period for residents to speak up about Hennepin's appointment. 95% of those comments were in favor. And Hennepin actually is a legit water guy. He was the acting general manager of the Sustainable Water Initiative for Tomorrow, that's SWIFT, which is a water purification initiative in Eastern Virginia, and he contributes to the ocean research project SeaLevelRise.org. That is an educational platform that analyzes data to inform on the risks, causes, and solutions to sea level rise. He's also white. This is important in a minute. So the guy knows water, and we'll get into money in a minute, but I want to say, reading through Hennepin's work in Jackson, something strikes me as perhaps understated but hugely significant. Water billing. Hennepin's policy of billing collection is, get this, compassionate. Hennepin officially took his role in Jackson in December 2022, and his policy on billing is that Jackson residents would only receive billing statements for service provided after he took his position. So you remember how the governor was like, fix your billing, and the billing system was fucked? Hennepin was like, hey, the billing is fucked, and we can't collect tens of thousands of dollars from residents with busted water pipes. So all the back charges, they basically just got pushed off to the side. Hennepin decided not to charge him for it. He basically started over. In the future, if Jackson wants to try to collect on those charges, they can, but Hennepin isn't going after it. He only wants to bill for a functioning water service. And Hennepin is in this for the long haul. Initially, he was just like going to be there a year, but he's agreed to a 4-year stint as head of Jackson's water authority, after which he will then move on. The good news in short order. Hennepin took over in December 2022, and in June of 2023, the EPA awarded the city of Jackson $115 million to support water infrastructure investments. And as part of the 2023 federal budget, President Biden secured an additional $600 million in supplemental disaster funding specifically for the city of Jackson. So there you go. Everything solves. Wrapped up in a neat little package. Ah, fuck. I forgot two things. All right, so the money. All right, remember how the state of Mississippi passed legislation to take over the Jackson Airport? Well, Jackson, Mississippi went back on some bullshit with the $600 million allocated to Jackson. And just keep in mind that $600 million is specifically for Jackson's water infrastructure. Not potholes, just the water. Senate Bill 2889, sponsored by David Parker of Olive Branch, and designed by the Lieutenant Governor's Office, proposes the creation of a regional water authority board to oversee Jackson's water, sewer, and drainage system once Hennepin's 4-year appointment is over. So, we have the state of Mississippi pushing for control of the airport, the water system, and replacing Jackson police with state police and overseeing its court systems. Oh, do you remember that? The state police? The Jackson police? They wanted to do away with the Jackson Police Department and have like Mississippi State Police in the city instead of Jackson. Did you remember that? That's just minor detail, different episode. Mayor Lumumba's statements on this whole thing, quote, it reminds me of apartheid. They dictate our leadership, put a military force over us, and we're just supposed to pay taxes to the king, end quote. That's pretty astute. Then there's the community at large, whose interests are being pushed by community advocacy groups. What do I mean by that? The appointment of Hennepin was court-ordered. The whole broken infrastructure thing is being overseen by a federal court. That is the proposed stipulated order in the EPA lawsuit. It's a whole thing. So two local advocacy groups, People's Advocacy Institute and Mississippi Poor People's Campaign, filed a motion to become parties to the suit. In addition to the existing parties, the Department of Justice, the EPA, Mississippi Department of Health, and the City of Jackson. The group's concerns are, to be frank, reasonable. They want departmental transparency from Hennepin, and they want to see those funds, $700 million plus at this point, go in part to creating employment opportunities for folks in Jackson. That makes sense, right? Live here, work here. Here are some of the points of what these two groups want. Assuring the public the return of local water control of the water system once Hennepin leaves. Requiring Jackson Water to comply with public record and procurement laws, requiring regular community meetings as well as input from the community over hiring and contracting decisions, requiring monthly water system updates versus the current quarterly requirement, requiring a community ombudsman to consult with Jackson Water over important decisions, and alerting residents of boil water notices in person via text, email, phone call, and social media. Basically, they only give like one or two ways to do the boil notice and people look at their phones more. Okay. I think all that's reasonable. The group's transparency and communication concerns are that Jackson residents aren't receiving vital information or enough of it from the water service when it directly concerns quality or availability of water. Again, this makes sense considering that's the entire point of the lawsuit. Judge Wingate, presiding over a July 2023 status conference on the case, heard concerns from the local residents that confirmed the advocacy groups were sound in their demands. Residents also expressed concern about the lack of local Black leadership at Jackson Water and that large contracts were going to out-of-state vendors, kind of like the Siemens thing all over again. In response to the comments made at the conference by advocates, Wingate had this to say, quote, overall, the presentations from Hennepin's critics were either uninformed, short-sighted, clearly political, well-intentioned but naive, or, as earlier discussed, racist, end quote. That's not good. That's not good. In response, Mississippi Poor People's Campaign advocate Danielle Holmes said, quote, "This isn't an attack on Mr. Hennepin. This is not a black or white issue. When the judge makes a statement that we just want someone black to fix our water, that's very disingenuous," end quote. And they actually like Hennepin. Here's the thing. They like Hennepin. I'm going to wrap this up with Kimberly Leifert's response or a statement. She's an attorney at the National Resources Defense Council. Quote, "Safe drinking water is a basic human right. It is unacceptable that Jackson's predominantly African-American community has had to spend years fighting for it. As the emergency petition to the EPA makes clear, the federal government must take steps to ensure the people of Jackson receive safe drinking water. Solving Jackson's water crisis will require the EPA to listen to community leadership while enforcing the law so that trust in the water system is repaired, just like the water system itself." So I know that just ended abruptly, but that's the end of the script. That's the end of all that. I kind of ended it that way because there is no neat resolution. Like, they're still in the midst of dealing with it. The money is still tied up with the state government. Everybody's an asshole. Hennepin's trying his best. The community advocacy groups are still out there, and they're still doing the work. And it's frustrating that one of the founding members of one of these advocacy groups, her father worked for the water system, and Hennepin fired him as part of when he came on board. And so now there is this perceived resentment, if you will, between this woman and Hennepin, even though clearly she does not say anything negative about Hennepin, just that the community needs to be more involved. But this has taken on its own life form. She's accused of, you know, holding a grudge or whatever, and so the complaints of the group are not taken seriously. I felt it was important to end on the note about community involvement, because when you get down to it, that's what the entire thing is about, is that the community does not have good representation, not in the state, not even in its own city. And all they want is what we have in basically every other major American city, even small cities: clean fucking water, toilets that work. Like, that's all they're asking for. And time and time and time again, they are basically just pushed to the side in favor of someone else's desires, whims, need for power, whatever.
Well, I think what's interesting, well, one, yes. One, yes, everything you just said. But two, I think that this might be a complicated thing to say. In fact, I'm sure it probably is a complicated thing for me to say, but it is and isn't about community involvement. It's about, to me, when I listen to all of this unfold as you discuss it, having lived in Mississippi, continuing to live in Tennessee, you know, it's about who as a country and who within a state we think our community is. Because if I am an engaged, equitably minded citizen of a state or a country, a commonwealth, a community, what I want is for everyone in my community to receive equally adequate service of the things that we all understand to be our rights. And so the fact that we're talking about just one city in a whole state and the question of whether or not they as a city can get their act together or not, I mean, to me it's about, or whether or not they've got representation. The big picture question is, why is the entire state of Mississippi not concerned that there is a chunk of Mississippians who do not have access to what every person in Mississippi should have access to? And that should outrage every citizen of the state of Mississippi. But there's not a sense of community feeling across the entire state. And that speaks to some of the problems with small government in the first place. And that's the part that, like, rings all the alarms in my mind.
I think...
Sorry.
No, I mean, this is where the unscripted part gets the best of me. You're 100% right. What I noticed about living in Mississippi myself is, whether it was the way I look at the world or whether it was true, it feels very much like a segregated place still, even in Hattiesburg. talking heads on the news can talk about, you know, whether or not we have systemic racism and whether or not that's real. But when you go to a place like Mississippi, you can feel, it is a very real feeling, that there is a huge separation between black and white. And when it comes to this specifically, it seems so egregious that in the state legislature, run mostly by white people, huge majority white, with a white governor who blatantly says shit like, give me your airport. And then you have other people who say, remember when we had the last white mayor? It is just blatantly racist. And I don't have the words to articulate.
Well, the problem is that I wish it were blatantly racist, but it isn't. Miss that guy, right? Like, that isn't, if it were blatant racism, I mean, anyone who's listening to this should go back and just type into YouTube or Google Lee Atwater plus Southern strategy.
Oh, yes.
Right? And there is like a 2 or 3 minute clip of him talking about the evolution of like dog whistle politics. And he's like, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, we used to just be able to say nigger, 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 nigger. And then we couldn't say that anymore. And so we said things like busing and school districts and whatever else. And now we can't even say that. Now we just talk about welfare and we talk about, you know, but it's all the same thing. It's still nigger, 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 right? And, but it's not blatant anymore. So all I'm saying is, like, there has been this very deliberate movement towards ensuring that it is not blatant so that people cannot actually call it out, because there is so much protection for white people who are still advancing these profoundly racist policies, and we don't have a place to call it out because it's been so embedded in subtlety and in these very movable, malleable, amorphous forms that socially, like, we can't speak about it. And then the new way of manifesting your profound white supremacy and racism is couched in such well-scripted rhetoric that when you call it out, you're called a racist and a crazy person, and the white people are protected, right? And they're allowed to claim, how dare you call me a racist? That is so ugly. I didn't say anything like that. All I said was that I just named my needs, that I need them to sell me this airport, right? Like, where's the racism?
Here's why I think it is blatant, because I speak that language. Mm-hmm. Like, it is, I think this is why I got called racist against whites, is because I was willing to say, no, the shit that you do, that you think is secret or you think is, you know,
but there are so few people who speak the modern iteration of white racism who are willing to translate it outside of their culture. Like, people like you that are willing to be like, no, that is racism. That is, like, I was trained to hear it, and I know that that's what it is, and I'm going to announce that to the world. There are so few people that are willing to own and claim that that's what it is, who are not people of color. Because, like, people of color sitting here going, it sounds the same to me, whether they're saying, sell me your airport, nigger, nigger, nigger. It sounds the same thing. sounds exactly the same.
It right? is the same. It is.
But, like, to the well-meaning white American ear, they sound very different.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only person that who's not a black person who could name that they're the same is a white person who's been on the inside, who's willing to talk about it, which is why I am so invested in having conversations with white people who come from the belly of the beast, right? Because, like, people who come from that and are willing to talk about the language that they know that is very secret, that's going to be what dismantles, or that's a really important part of what dismantles this.
And here's the consequence of that. This is why people don't do it. Because we know what it's like to be, we know what they think about people on the outside. And I do this a lot in the podcast. I always call anybody that's not a straight white male the other, because that's how it's viewed. And you know that if you don't keep playing along in those circles, you will become the other. And that's very isolating. And to be honest with you, I have grew up my entire life feeling that way, like, very much. And now I'm approaching 40, and I'm like, am I really going to live the rest of my life like this? Like being afraid of not being accepted by this group of people that I really don't like or agree with? And this is a huge tangent. The thing is, I actually do, like, as individuals, like the people that I'm around. It's like, it is difficult to actually convince others who don't hear the racism that no, what they're doing, that shit is fucked. That is completely fucked. And there, so I agree with you 100%. It's not blatant in that they have that plausible deniability where they can say, no, we're literally just talking about an airport. No, we don't want to spend federal emergency dollars on potholes. That's absurd. And you go on down the line, everything that we talked about. I mean, every single level, there is a chance for someone to back out and say, whoa, no, this has nothing to do with race. This is money. This is, we want to make sure that, you know, things are getting fixed. We want to make sure there's proper oversight, all that stuff. But time and again, I mean, you just looking at the racial makeup, you're like, why are they treating this one place like this? And you can be completely racist against an entire place. And I think that's what's happening. And it's horrible. It's horrifying. This was actually like a horrifying episode to do. And I've done episodes on like rape and stuff like that. But this, like, every single time you think, like, okay, well, eventually, like, someone is going to step in, and no, there is even Ted Hennepin is eventually, he will go away, and he is not the white savior who's going to save the water. As soon as it's gone, they've already said they're going to try to take it over. It doesn't have a happy ending. I don't see how it does. If you could tell me that I'm wrong, I would feel I'd be able to sleep better at night. But I don't know. The answer is I don't know. This is actually how I end a lot of my episodes, with just saying, I have no fucking idea, and this is the episode.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we have to accept the gray area. Which I will let you end it and say the answer is we don't know.
I was horrified when Russia invaded Ukraine and Ukrainians were left without water and they drank from puddles. I was horrified when Israel shut off water into Gaza, the very people that they're bombing. I'm horrified daily by the rising body count, not only from bombs in Gaza, but from the lack of food and water. And I am ashamed to say that I was not equally horrified about the Mississippi water crisis, or even Flint, when I first heard about it. And kind of like what you've said, things won't change until they affect you personally. It took me realizing that I was concerned about these people all the way across the world about water, when I had been ignoring the same issues here. Not ignoring, but sort of passing them over, like, oh, it's America. We'll take care of it. It's fine. That is so complacent and dangerous. And I can say now that it is, having done just the research for this episode, it is horrifying to see how it plays out with Americans who I could go and drive to, like, tonight and visit and learn about. Like, it is not far away. The only thing that I have to add to anything that Caroline has said is, I can't actually add to what Caroline has said, because you have summed it up absolutely perfectly. I'm going to use your words at the very end, because it was perfect.
The answer is that in any system, until the people in power are negatively affected at rates that they find intolerable, things don't change. And that's just it. That's all there is. It's like, you know, people can be homophobic, and then their child comes out and somehow their mind is changed. People can be anti-Semitic, and then their child marries somebody or converts, and then their mind is changed. People don't change until they have to. And have to is either personal or fiscal.
That, like, is very well put. That is perfect. Yes.
And, like, and so I don't know. And the poor Black people of Jackson not having water is not going to affect the pocketbook of the rich white people of Mississippi. Unfortunately. So unless their water gets bad, and somehow fixing their water also fixes the water of Jackson, I don't know if it will get better.
And like every episode, I'm going to close out by, Caroline, is there anything you would like to promote, add, say, anything like that?
If you're listening to this, please read the newspaper every day. Read more than one newspaper every day. Read one that makes sense to you and one that frustrates you. And please vote, and please make sure that everyone you know and love is registered to vote and is planning to vote in November, because one way or the other, we must engage in democracy, and the will of the people needs to start being the present body in the White House, period.
This is Unfuck the Poor. I'm Joseph Love. This was Caroline Randall Williams.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
This is one of my favorite episodes, I think, ever, but I say that about every episode, so they're all my favorite.
I'm coming back so you say it about only mine.
Perfect. Deal.